But the talk tonight is going to begin to point to the practices that we do in daily life. The Dharma practice is traditionally described as a threefold training of sila, samadhi, and panya. Sila refers to virtue, morality, the purity of our conduct. Samadhi describes the mental development that occurs through mindfulness, the application of ourselves in meditation and concentration. And panya describes a wisdom, a wise view, a wise use of the mind, a clear thought. How we conduct ourselves, this aspect of sila, is very much the foundation of our practice. As Gandhi said, how I live my life, that is my teaching. And when I think about practice in daily life, I don't think about how many minutes do we spend with our eyes closed. I think about how we live. I think about our conduct, and in particular, the structure of the precepts and a real clear looking at our conduct. Patril Rinpoche, a great Tibetan yogi, said, "Do not take lightly small misdeeds, believing they can do no harm. Even a tiny spark of fire can set alight a mountain of hay. Do not take lightly small good deeds, believing they can hardly help, for drops of water one by one in time can fill a giant pot." At the beginning of this retreat, we spoke of the five precepts. These are five basic ethical commitments that are guides for our action. They include the restraint from killing and causing harm, restraint from stealing or taking what's not given, restraint from untrue or harmful speech, restraint from sexual misconducts, and restraint around intoxicants. In the discourses of the Buddha, more commonly than finding the five precepts, one finds the 10 kinds of conduct that are 10 kinds of wholesome conduct and 10 kinds of unwholesome conduct. And it's more or less the precepts, but with a bit expanded here or there. And it includes the unwholesome is killing for bodily conduct, is killing living beings or abstaining from killing living beings, taking what's not given by way of theft, or refraining from taking what's not given by way of theft. The third, for bodily misconduct, is misconduct regarding sensual pleasures, or refraining from misconduct in sensual pleasures. And then there are four kinds of verbal conduct: speaking falsehood or refraining from speaking falsehood, speaking maliciously to create discord, or refraining from speaking maliciously to create discord, speaking harshly or refraining from speaking harshly, gossiping or refraining from gossiping. And then there are three kinds of mental conduct that lead to suffering, or its opposite, the restraint leads to happiness. And that includes coveting the wealth or property of others, or refraining from coveting, having thoughts of ill will and intentions of hate, or refraining from thoughts of ill will and intentions from hate, or possessing wrong view, distorted vision, or refraining from wrong view. Now, that may sound kind of complicated, especially in English, but we can practice with the 10 kinds of wholesome or unwholesome conduct, or we can practice with the five precepts. Interestingly, these 10 occur more frequently in the discourses, but it's much easier to remember a list of five. Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche said, "Of all the countless living beings throughout the vast reaches of the universe, every single one, right down to the tiniest insect, wants only to be happy and not suffer." but none of them understand in their search for happiness that happiness comes only from positive action. And none of them can see that in their efforts to escape suffering, that what brings suffering upon them is negative action. So unwittingly, they turn their backs on happiness and plunge into suffering. To expect happiness without giving up negative action is like holding your hand in a fire and hoping not to be burned. Of course, no one actually wants to suffer, to be sick, to be cold or hungry. But as long as we continue to indulge in wrongdoing, we will never put an end to suffering. Likewise, we will never achieve happiness except through positive deeds, words, and thoughts. Positive action is something that we cultivate ourselves. It cannot be bought nor stolen, and no one ever stumbles on it just by chance. I'm sure every one of you who has attended a retreat before has heard a talk on the precepts. When I lived in the monasteries in Thailand, virtually every Dharma talk would begin with a little bit of a talk on dana and a little bit of a talk on sila, long before they would give any instruction in mindfulness or concentration practice. Because how we conduct ourselves and the purity of our action is considered so vital and indispensable to the development of the mind that mindfulness and concentration practice, meditation practice, is considered fairly superfluous or useless without a firm base in ethical conduct. But this doesn't imply that precept practice and training is just for beginners. Our conduct and our motivation in our action is always an arena for our reflection. And I found that the deeper our practice goes, the more keenly we are interested in our conduct and the more carefully we work with these precepts. There's a tremendous power that comes in undertaking these precepts. Power for clearing out the mind, for cleansing, for, in a way, finishing unfinished business and cleaning up our act. And this supports the unification of mind, the strengthening of mind. I want to consider this precept practice on a number of different levels. The first is just as a simple act of kindness and generosity, because we keep the precepts as a way of being gentle, being kind, expressing sensitivity to ourselves and to others, to live in harmony in community. Working with the precepts encourages us to turn our minds away from habits or tendencies of selfishness, of greed, of reactivity, and of anger, and to turn our mind toward kindness, caring, compassion, love, and harmony. So a basic gesture of kindness and generosity includes working with these precepts. There's a beautiful discourse that describes each of the precepts as a gift, giving to immeasurable beings freedom from fear, freedom from hostility, through undertaking each of the five precepts. It's a gift that we make. The second way of working with the precepts is as a way of protecting our minds. We can nurture calmness and eliminate agitation and stress in our minds, the stress that comes from guilt, from remorse, from saying things that we regret, simply by protecting our minds with the precepts. If we are rough in our speech, if we are coarse in our action, if we do things that hurt or harm other beings, sometimes we then come into the meditation hall and we sit down and we find that it's very difficult to be with ourselves. Our mind is agitated because of those actions. In long retreats, it's not uncommon for people to sit in the silence and then suddenly grieve something that they did that hurt somebody weeks ago, months ago, even years ago. These disruptions are very unsettling in the meditation. And so we start to recognize how incredibly important the purity of our conduct is in order to attain pure mental states. We literally create torments for ourselves through our own harmful actions. And during meditation, we feel the repercussions of those actions. It's said that sila is absolutely necessary for samadhi to develop. It's a foundation that allows the mind to rest at ease. During the first, or after the first three-month retreats that I attended, I had thought going into each one that I'd get all charged up and revved up and my practice would really take off. And it did. But after each one, we would meet in the little small group circles before leaving the retreat to say what we were taking away, what we were committing to develop in our practice. And the first three-month retreats, I was very surprised to realize that what I was really fired up about was to be much more impeccable, much more precise, much more careful about my precepts. And those first several years of my practice were a time that I worked very diligently with each of them to refine them and to take great care. Because there I was sitting 2 months into a retreat and, I just had a thought and it was like overwhelmed me that I was so mean to somebody with something that I said, or that I had actually taken something that really wasn't fully given. It was kind of like manipulated my way. You know, these little things that can come up and just not be clear. And I realized that my meditation practice could not develop any further than the clarity of my conduct. And so I made a big commitment to cultivate very refined precepts and to really look into them, because I saw the link between any agitation in conduct and an agitation in mind that prevented concentration. The third way of working with the precepts is to just consider them a support for mindfulness practice, because our sensitivity increases as our mindfulness increases, and taking the precepts, making a commitment to look at our conduct, gives us a signal of what to pay attention to. It's kind of like when we sit down in meditation, formal meditation practice, we create a stable posture. And that stable posture in the stillness is a territory for mindfulness. And when we make a commitment to the precepts, we've created another container that then, should we stray outside of it, should we cross the line, we really notice it. It's just like moving in the meditation after you've made a commitment to stay still, or speaking after you've made a commitment to silence. We really notice it. We're immediately mindful of it. When we work with the precepts, though, it's important that we bring a lot of the qualities that we learn about mindfulness, to be non-judgmental, to really accept the vulnerability and the imperfections as we train our hearts and minds towards more peace. Working with the precepts is not about self-blame, self-condemnation. It's not about judging ourselves. Oh, I'm such a horrible person. It's all my fault. That doesn't support the development of our virtue. Precept training simply offers another way of viewing our actions so that we're not so drawn into the dramas of our personal desires and stories, seeing, oh, this is good, this is bad, I'm good, I'm bad. But we simply look at our actions and see what leads to happiness and what leads to harm. What supports the welfare of my own mind and what supports the welfare of my communities? And what leads to harm in my own mind and what leads to harm in communities and the world? There are a series of discourses that the Buddha gave to his own son, Rahula, which are quite touching. It's very interesting. I mean, I don't know that the Buddha was the best dad. I mean, he did kind of abandon his son when he was born. But he later trained him in the Dhamma and in the discipline in a very powerful way. And one of the very clear teachings that are given to Rahula is where he teaches him to reflect in a way that purifies body, speech, and mind. So this includes those 10 forms of conduct of body, speech, and mind. And the encouragement is to consider what really motivates our actions, what are our intentions. And we reflect before we do an action. If I do this action, will it lead to my affliction, my harm? Will it lead to the harm of others or to the affliction of both myself and others? And then can we consider, will it lead to my benefit, to the benefit of others or to the benefit of both? He's basically asking us to consider, what do we think the consequences are going to be? But we don't know. So we make the best choice we can, and then we start doing the action. And while we're doing the action, he says, reflect again during the course of this action. Is it for my benefit, the benefit of others, the benefit of both, the affliction of self, the affliction of others, the affliction of both? Affliction, harm. Harm. So we reflect on those wholesome or unwholesome results before doing an action, while we're doing the action, and then again after we've done the action. Then we look back and we think, oh, what was the effect? And then we learn for future, to refine our reflection in the future. Then he says, if we find that even though we've reflected and we've tried, we've still chosen a course of action that has caused harm, then we correct ourselves, or we confess, we apologize, and we resolve to restrain ourselves in the future. And if we find that we've done a course of action that has been of benefit to self and others, then we abide glad and happy, practicing day and night, cultivating wholesome state. I love this line, to look at our actions and to then abide glad and happy. We purify the mind by repeatedly reflecting. So this way, our meditation practice and our daily life are both about mindfulness. We don't necessarily do mindfulness in daily life by just reminding ourselves to feel our breath. You know, like some people set their alarm on the watch to beep every hour and they feel a mindful breath. Well, that's nice. But I really think the precept practice is the core of daily life practice. When we really take care of our precepts, then we do find that we are training day and night in wholesome states. Shantideva said, Whenever I wish to move or to speak, first I shall examine my state of mind and firmly act in a suitable way. Whenever my mind becomes attached or angry, I shall not react, nor shall I speak. I shall remain mum and unmoved like a tree. So we bring mindfulness to our actions and we investigate them to see, well, what are our intentions? Is this action coming out of greed and hatred? Or is this action coming out of compassion and clarity, calmness? The next way I view precept training is as a practice of wisdom, literally as an expression of our wisdom. It's not about right and wrong. It's about seeing cause and effect. Quoting Patril Rinpoche again. When the eagle soars up high above the earth, its shadow for a while is nowhere to be seen. Yet bird and shadow still are linked, so too our actions. When conditions come together, their effects are clearly seen. Our effects, our actions have effects. They become causes for future experiences. They condition different tendencies within us. In the Middle Length Discourses, there's a discourse called The Greater Discourse on the Way of Undertaking Things. And it's a lovely little discourse where the Buddha begins a talk by asking the assembly, or for speaking to an assembly. He says, for the most part, beings have a wish, longing, and desire. If only unwished for, undesired, disagreeable things would diminish, and wished for, desired, agreeable things would increase. Now, those are a lot of long words, but I don't think much has changed in the last few thousand years, because we still want unpleasant events to go away and more pleasant events to come our way. And the Buddha goes on to say, even though beings have these wishes for more pleasure and less pain, they continue to do things that increase the pain and don't increase the pleasure, because they don't know what should be cultivated and what should not be cultivated. So the Buddha is saying that people basically keep blowing it. You know, we keep making mistakes. We're doing the very things that perpetuate unhappiness, because we're not seeing how conduct bears fruit. So then the question comes, how do we know what we should do and what we should not do? How do we know what we should cultivate and develop and what we should not cultivate and develop? And fortunately, he gives us a list. There are four ways of undertaking things. I love these lists. I have a student in the States who took a bunch of the lists, and he's just made a set of cards, and he sent it to me as he wanted me to check it, to look at the Pali and to look at his choice of words and definitions and things. And so after my meditation group, some people stayed and we dealt them out, and we played a game like, I was holding my thing and I said, do you have a noble truth? And then you'd have to give me your noble truth. And then I'd learn the Pali on the noble truth. And I put it, and then, you get to lay them down when you get all four. And then somebody else would ask, do you have a factor of enlightenment? Yes, I have two factors of enlightenment. Here they are. And they could lay them down as a group and get points when they get all the factors of enlightenment. Anyway, it's a nice game, probably by the time I come, in a year, he'll have it available. It'll be available on the internet. But anyway, There's a list of four ways of undertaking things. There's a way of undertaking things that is painful now and painful in the future. Would you do it? Right, you wouldn't. It's obvious. And he likens this to being somebody saying, here's a bowl of poison, and it tastes terrible, and it's going to kill you. Will you take it? No. And then somebody comes along and says, I have this bowl of poison. It'll kill you, but oh, it tastes great. Would you take it? Mm-hmm. You would. No.
We all do.
But that's what he says is what's pleasant now, but painful in the future. Then what about somebody who says, here's some medicine. Ooh, it tastes bitter, but it's going to cure you of your ills. Would you take it? Or the medicine that's of honey, tastes like honey, and it also will cure you of your ills. Would you take it? Okay, yeah, we might double the dose, but still. That's what's painful now and pleasant in the future, and what's pleasant now and pleasant in the future. So we have this four-part combination. And the Buddha continuously says we shouldn't make our decision as to what to do based on how it feels in the present. Whether it's pleasant or unpleasant is not the basis upon which a wise person makes a decision. But we consider the likely future result and make our decision based upon that. This requires a bit of mindfulness to undertake, to really notice how quickly we might respond to, ew, I don't want to do that, it tastes bad, or, ew, I want that, and not think about the likely consequences. The effects of this on our precepts, on our conduct, are very clear, but we can think about lots of ecological examples where there isn't a long-range consideration, lots of global concerns and social concerns where a wise decision may be painful now or may be challenging or difficult or require some restraint, and yet it will lead to benefit in the future. So this kind of a teaching encourages us to bring this wisdom into our actions. But Patro Rinpoche says that it's important there's a positive action that we have to do in relationship to these actions of body, speech, and mind. And he said that the positive action that must be adopted is to take a resolute vow never to commit any of the 10 negative actions. So it's not enough to simply, by chance, not steal, not kill, not lie, not engage in all of those negative actions of body, speech, and mind. But there's power, there's strength, there's merit in taking the vow and making the commitment to refrain. And then we practice the antidotes. To protect life, to cultivate generosity, to maintain a discipline, to tell the truth, to speak pleasantly, to reconcile disputes, to clarify our minds. Working with our actions even is a way of overcoming even subtle tendencies towards ill will or harmfulness. And sometimes we're going to have to confront this tendency. We might find that we actually have a greedy streak that's hard to accept, or a real cruel streak that we don't want really anybody to see. At times, we might need to really refrain from impulses that lead to suffering and harm. But we can decide not to give in to the momentum of these harmful impulses, even the minor ones. This kind of precept training requires creativity, it requires integrity, strength, courage, mindfulness, and commitment. Because there are going to be times when each of us have to go against our own tendencies, where we have an impulse towards something. And nobody will see us, but it'll break our precepts. And we'll have to have the strength to trust our precepts more than our impulses. We'll have to go against the tendencies of some friends or some family or some society's expectations at times to maintain a clarity of our precepts. Sometimes there are demands upon us at work or in social groups that don't quite feel right to us. We might need to bring some thought about our action to the use of money, to investments, to the use of materials, to how we live, to what we drive, to the way we speak, to who we speak to the tone of our speech, to the kinds of gossip that we might engage in, to how we entertain ourselves, to our sexual relations, to what we consume and what we drink. Sometimes we scrutinize and look very closely at the details of our lives so that we make our action a very conscious part of our practice. Not from this place of self-judgment, but from understanding that when we're deeply committed to compassion and to awakening, we see the interconnectedness of all things and we want to act in a clear and conscious way. I recommend working very diligently with each precept and to kind of break them down, piece them out, take them as little components, find some little projects to do. When I did my years of precept practice, I kept little notebooks with me, and I would say, okay, this week I'm going to specifically work on such and such a precept. And every time there was an impulse that could have breached the precept, I would jot it down so that I'd have to look at the tendencies of my mind. Because otherwise I'd think, oh, well, I didn't do it, I'm okay. But that impulse arose, and I wanted to look and see so that it didn't build up. And then I would write them down all week long, you know, mostly they were impulses and sometimes they were actions. But mostly I was amazed at how many little harmful impulses there were in a day that didn't get to action. But, you know, in a tired, cranky kind of, if I'm tired and unmindful, they could have. So I jotted them down. And I didn't analyze them each day. I waited until the end of the week. And then I looked at each of the pages and analyzed them and thought about them and sat and looked at them and saw the patterns and the thoughts about them. Sometimes I took a big, big sheet of paper and put it on the back of my door. And I wrote them really big so that I couldn't keep them away in a little pocket. And I'm like really big in marker pen on the back of the door. And sometimes I had little projects, all sorts of little projects I would just make up as I went along. And I encourage you to be creative, but to really take the precepts one by one and look at them very carefully. Mostly I was working with the impulses and the restraint and the refraining, but you can just as easily work with the antidotes and cultivating the supportive factors. There's lots of things to do with them. I don't think there's sort of a special technique. The Buddha didn't say put a little piece of paper on the back of your door and write them down. But he did say to reflect, you know, to really reflect on our conduct. Some way or other, we have to notice what our weaknesses are. And we watch for those tendencies and then guard our minds even more in an area or a condition where we know that we're in danger. Often I think our real dangers are our internal dangers, when we could cause harm. I also look for what's called compelling energy, that feeling like things have got to be this way and they've got to be this way now. Or I always am about to break a precept if I try to get something over with. I found that to be a very clear pattern. You know, I want to get through something, I want to get it over with. I don't want to really rest then and know that what I'm doing is in some way or other a little bit twisted. So I found that that compelling energy and that wish to get through something quickly is a sign to me that I'm doing something that I don't really want to be doing, that's not quite right. And so I make myself stop and I make myself feel what's going on. I don't just get it over with and hide it or push it away. So whatever you find to be your patterns, we interrupt them and then we look at them. And then we recognize our error. Oh, not enlightened yet. And we begin again. As simple as that. No beating ourselves up. We just begin again and continue to purify the mind. There is a very positive aspect to our precept training. Because we have so many options. Every hindrance that we see, we have an option of overcoming it. Every nasty little tendency in our mind, we have an option of overcoming it. Every little twisted part of our personality and character, we have a way of overcoming it. In the Salekha Sutta, the Buddha said that there is an uneven path, kind of a rocky path, and then there's an even, smooth path by which to avoid the rocky path. And then there's a list. I'll only say a few of them because this list has 44 qualities. A person given to cruelty has non-cruelty by which to avoid it. A person given to taking what is not given, to stealing, has abstention from taking what is not given by which to avoid it. So in this, recognize that he is acknowledging that we're people and we have tendencies and we might be kind of inclined toward these things. But even if we are inclined towards cruelty, we can abstain. One given to gossip has abstention from gossip by which to avoid it. One given to ill will has non-ill will by which to avoid it. One given to restlessness has non-restlessness by which to avoid it. One given to arrogance has non-arrogance by which to avoid it. It goes on, 44 qualities, and they're non in or it, by which to avoid it. It's in the Middle Link Discourses, number 8, if you want to read the whole list of 44. But I love this discourse because sometimes we think we have to come up with these creative practices and some really special esoteric practice. And all we have to do is really abstain. And that will solve an awful lot of the struggles that we have in our minds. Abstention is a very powerful option. I'd like to end this talk with a quote by A. Whitney Griswold. Self-respect cannot be hunted. It cannot be purchased. It is never for sale. It cannot be fabricated out of public relations. It comes to us when we are alone, in quiet moments, in quiet places, when we suddenly realize that knowing the good we have done it, and knowing the beautiful we have served it, knowing the truth we have spoken it. I'd like you to reflect for a moment on your feeling about the precepts, and if there's some wish to make a deeper commitment to them. And I'd like to chant the five precepts under Sila in the middle here. I'll say the words in Pali, and then you can, we'll do call and response. You can repeat them back. And have a sense of, if you would like, rather than just repeating the words, have a sense of placing your heart in the practice so that we're really undertaking the precepts in, as if you would like. The third precepts, you'll see that there are two. When we're in retreat, we make the commitment to undertake the precept of celibacy, which is abrahmacharya, viramani, sikapadam, samadhiyami. But in daily life, we undertake the precept kamasumichachara, viramani, sikapadam, samadhiyami, which basically means to refrain from sexual misconduct. So since we'll be leaving the retreat tomorrow, I'd like to do the daily life precept as the one we chant, but please understand that tonight we are maintaining celibacy. So there's no misunderstanding here. Panatipata Viramani. And then you say, Panatipata Viramani. Sikapadam Samadhiyami. Sikapadam Samadhiyami. That's I undertake the precept to abstain from killing. Adinadana Viramani. Adinadana Viramani. Sikapadam Samadhiyami. Sikapadam Samadhiyami. I undertake the precept to abstain from stealing. Kamasumichachara. Kamasumichachara Viramani. Sikapadam Samadhiyami.
Sikapadam Samadhiyami.
I undertake the precept to abstain from sexual misconduct. Mutsavara Viramani.
Mutsavara Viramani.
Sikapadam Samadhiyami.
Sikapadam Samadhiyami.
I undertake the precept to abstain from wrongful speech. Sura Merya Machapamadatana.
Sura Merya Machapamadatana.
Viramani. Sikapadam Samadhiyami.
Sikapadam Samadhiyami.
I undertake the precept to abstain from intoxicants. Imam Pancha Silam Samadhiyami.
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 We have 5 minutes of sitting.